purpose of our studying these Proverbs is to try to learn something the easy way rather than the hard way. We don't want to have to learn everything by making mistakes. We want to be able to learn from good advice and good counsel. And that's what this collection of sayings is. We've been taking just a chapter each Lord's Day and choosing three or four Proverbs out of it and trying to think about how to apply that in a practical way. This morning our chapter will be Proverbs chapter 15, but there was one more in chapter 14 that I want to talk to you about a little bit before we get there. So look with me in Proverbs chapter 14 at verse 23. Proverbs 14, verse 23. The wise man said, "In all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty." Now, obviously, some labor is not even all that profitable. Some labor is just evil in its nature. I have thought numerous times if the people who sit down and do all the work writing computer viruses and things like that, if they would put that skill to good use, it could really be beneficial to lots of folks. Some labor is not very profitable because it's not very well conceived. It's not very well organized. It's not very efficient in how it's done. But I think what the wise man is trying to tell us here is that even the poorest effort will accomplish more than just talking about it. We've got to do something more than just talk about a circumstance. If we want there to be some profit or benefit to come, we have to do something. Now again, Proverbs has a lot to say about the importance of advice. We considered a proverb in chapter 11 about the success coming through a number of counselors. It tells us to plan. It tells us to think about it, talk about it, and to listen. But then it tells us to go to work. All talk and no action doesn't benefit a whole lot. We need to do something. That's true when it comes to jobs. Sometimes people talk a lot more about finding a job than they do something about finding a job. I've known people who were supposedly looking for work, but every time you talk to them, they hadn't really had an interview lately and didn't have anything particularly lined up. And there really wasn't a whole lot happening on that front. Or if somebody is interviewing, they may talk a big game with the manager about what they will do if hired, but then when hired, the performance isn't quite there. They start fussing about all the things they're expected to do. So there's not going to be much profit in that. But all talk and no action is also not going to accomplish much when you've got a problem. Now, it's good to think about the problem. It's good to analyze it. But sometimes when we have a bad situation occur, we sit around and talk about it and like, well, how did this happen? And the big question is, whose fault is this? We're big on assessing blame here. Who's responsible for this? And what's it going to take to get this done? And you know what? You just got to roll up your sleeves and get the job done. I remember several years ago when Sandy and I decided to put wood flooring in our house. Take out the carpet, put in the wood. We were warned that that would be messy. But we weren't adequately warned as to how messy that would be. And when those guys left that day, Sandy and I just looked at each other, and this house was a disaster from one end to another. And she was probably tempted to say, "I wish you'd have told me it was going to be this big a mess." Or we could say, "I wish we'd have done more." But, you know, there wasn't anything to do but roll up our sleeves and start cleaning. And for a week, we cleaned on that house for 1 week. Talking about it's not going to get it done, is it? We've got to do something. We've got to get to work. And that's also true in the matter of discipline as well. Just threatening some sort of consequences doesn't really accomplish a whole lot when consequences are needed. The preacher observed in his book of punishments in the civil realm that because a sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are given fully to do evil. If all the government does is threaten, but doesn't ever do anything, well, there's no profit in that. You know, the same thing's true in our homes. if we just constantly threaten our children, if you do that one more time, you know, but there are never any consequences, there never any profit comes from that. It needs to be action. And that's also true in churches. Sometimes we get to thinking about something that we think we might ought to do or like to do, and we talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. Eventually, indecision will cripple us. We've either got to decide to move ahead and start, or else we'll abandon it and go on to something else. And under this heading, I'm thinking about something my grandfather told me one time. My grandfather was a gospel preacher. And he told me one time, when I was a very young preacher, about meeting with the elders of the congregation where he was. And they had some members in the group that needed some attention. They needed some correction. And he said he met, and the elders talked about that, and they talked about this family and what needed to be done and that needed to be said. And he said the next time he met with them, which was several weeks later, this family's name came up, and they talked again about the family and what was done and what needed to be done. My grandfather said, I was sitting there thinking, in the time that we have met tonight to talk about this problem, we could have gone and addressed the problem by having the meeting at their house and talking to them about whatever needed them. Might have got the thing solved by that time. We need to act, and not just talk about things. And I wonder if under this heading, we might also include talking about things in prayer, but not doing anything about it. It's great for us to pray. We need to pray. We're taught to pray about a lot of situations, a lot of people's circumstances. But there may come a time when I need to stop praying for someone to be encouraged and then go do something to encourage them. Or to not just pray about the sick being comforted, but do something to go comfort somebody who's sick that I know. Or not just pray about the lost hearing the gospel, but doing something to take the gospel to those who are lost. All talk and no action just leads to poverty, the wise man said. And of course, we could make a grand application of this is with reference to serving the Lord. Anyone can claim to be a Christian. It takes no commitment. It takes no courage. It takes no strength. It takes no resolve to just say, I'm a Christian. To live as a Christian is something else altogether. Jesus asked in Luke chapter 6, verse 46, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? Or in Matthew 7, verse 21, he said, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Just talking about it leads to poverty. In work, there is profit, the wise man says. Okay, now let's go to chapter 15. And let's look at a couple of Proverbs there. We'll start in verse 1. I guess the most familiar verse in Proverbs chapter 15. A gentle answer. King James says a soft answer, and we're familiar with that. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. A gentle answer. A harsh word. The wise man says, I need to stop and think about how I'm responding to someone and the effect that that will have. And he cautions me against being harsh. I'll suggest to you there are three different ways in which our response to someone might be harsh. Number one, it might be harsh or gentle because of the tone that we use. Not so much the exact words we say, but how we say it, how it's communicated. Do you remember the account in the book of 2 Samuel chapter 6 about David moving the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem? You recall that didn't start out very well because they didn't move it according to the Lord's ordinance, and a man lost his life and David became angry and frustrated. The whole process stopped. And then David decided to try again. So on the second attempt, he had the priests to sanctify themselves. They moved the ark exactly in accordance with how God said to do it. In fact, they were so careful that the text indicates that they took about six steps and stopped, and then had a bunch of sacrifices again. And then they moved the procession on, bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. And this was one of David's most triumphant days. There was a big crowd there. The folks were shouting. They were blowing trumpets. And David was so excited, he put on a linen ephod, which was the dress a priest would normally wear. And he got out in front of the ark, and he was leaping and dancing and shouting to the Lord. He was on top of the world. And then he went home. And as he was coming home, Michael, his wife, went out to meet him. And she said to him, now the words are recorded in 2 Samuel 6, verse 20. The words are, "How the king of Israel distinguished himself today." And when we read our Bibles, we don't know exactly the tone with which something is said. But I envision those words to have come out something along the lines of how the king of Israel distinguished himself today. Because she went on to say that, as far as she was concerned, he had belittled himself in front of all of Israel's maidens. Now, if she didn't like what he had done, if she thought it was a little over the top or whatever and felt like correction was needed, it might have been appropriate to say something. That may not have been the very best time, but that was certainly not the best tone to use to make the point. But how we say something is important, how it comes across. And sometimes we don't intend something to come across perhaps as gruffly as it does on occasion. But a word might be harsh or gentle, as the case may be, not just on the basis of how it's said, but actually what is said. A harsh word stirs up anger. And if our words are such that they are highly critical and maybe, I'll say, hypercritical, where we start bringing in a lot of other things that are irrelevant in trying to make our point, or we start demeaning somebody's family or their accomplishments, or in some other way trying to really make them look small. And that's how we respond sometimes when we're in conflict. That's almost assuredly going to stir up anger. Look in the next verse in 2 Samuel 6 at how David responded to Michal. When she expressed her disgust at him, he said in verse 21 to her, "It was before the Lord who chose me above your father and over all his house to appoint me ruler over all the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore, I will celebrate before the Lord. You and your family were rejected. Remind you of that. I'm the king, and I'll do what I want to do." That's not the best response either. When I read this conversation, I think about another conversation that takes place a little bit later on in the book. In chapter 12, when Nathan has the task of going to David and confronting him about his sin with Bathsheba. And you think about how carefully chosen Nathan's words were. As he told the story about the,
the man with the little ewe lamb and the traveler coming to the rich man. And as he wove that story, and then it was time even to make the point to David, and he said to him, "You are the man," after David had announced his indignation. What a masterful illustration of the right way to address something there versus this illustration from 2 Samuel chapter 6. But it may be the message itself, the substance of what is said, that makes it harsh versus gentle. When I think about a soft answer in the King James, let's understand that a soft answer is not necessarily a compromising answer. A soft answer may well say what needs to be said. I think about Jesus and the woman they brought to Him. This story is recorded in John chapter 8. The woman who was taken in adultery. And the Lord turned to those who were incessantly calling upon Him to bring about some sort of a pronounce a judgment on her. He turned to that group of critics who obviously were dishonest in what they were doing and said, "Let him who is without sin among you cast the first stone." And then when they all left, He turned to the woman and said that He was not going to condemn her in the sense that they were looking for. But then He said to her, "Go and sin no more." Now that was a soft answer. That was a gentle answer. And yet it was a very firm one, wasn't it? He said what needed to be said. So my point is that a gentle answer doesn't have to be a compromising one, but it needs to be said in such a way as to bring about the best possible good. I have on the chart here two illustrations from the book of Judges. In Judges chapter 8, verses 1 through 3, versus Judges 12, 1 through 3. And time's getting away, so I'll not take time to turn and read those passages. You can do that on your own. But in Judges 8, the men of Ephraim were upset with Gideon because they hadn't been invited to the big battle in which he gained the victory over the Midianites. And so they called him about that. "Why didn't you invite us to the battle?" Well, he had called them for a mop-up operation, and in that they had captured a couple of kings. So rather than trying to just address them on their arrogance, he just humbly said, paraphrase, "What you did in capturing those two kings was far greater than what I did in the victory over the army." Judges 12, there's almost an identical circumstance. This time Jephthah is the judge. Jephthah has gone and won a victory over the Ammonites. And once again, the Ephraimites, and you get their feeling, they're kind of whiners in this book. But they come and once again complain, "Well, why didn't you call us to come into the battle?" Jephthah didn't have the judgment that Gideon had shown earlier. Jephthah said, "Well, I did call you and you didn't come." And then Jephthah got his army together and went to war against the Ephraimites. Gideon just felt like this is just not the time or the place to make a big point about this. Let's just let that go. And sometimes we just need to learn how to kind of diffuse a situation and let go what can be let go for the time till things cool down a bit. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. One more from Proverbs chapter 15. Again, we're just talking about a variety of subjects because that's what the Proverbs do. But this one I think will also be maybe helpful to us. Proverbs 15 and verse 15. The wise man said, "All the days of the afflicted are bad, but a cheerful heart has a continual feast." Almost every commentary I read on this passage this week took it that the person in verse 15 that's described as afflicted, the days of the afflicted, are somebody who has an afflicted heart versus the cheerful heart. In other words, the man is depressed and he's depressed, and so all of his days are bad. But the man who's cheerful, he has a continual feast. That might be. But the word afflicted in that first phrase is a word that almost everywhere else in the New Testament doesn't refer necessarily to a person's heart. It refers to his circumstances. It talks about somebody who is in poverty, mostly. Or if it's not somebody that's in poverty, it's somebody who is really being abused or taken advantage of in some way. So I wonder if the point is not this. If you are in a circumstance of affliction, those days, to be sure, are bad. It's hard. It hurts. And it's tough. But you can still choose to have a cheerful heart, and it will make those days a lot better, a lot more like a feast than a time of misery. Choose to have a cheerful heart. I want to read two passages of Bible characters who did just that in very adverse circumstances. One is the prophet Habakkuk in Habakkuk chapter 3. Habakkuk lived in a time when the people of Judah were most ungodly in their conduct, and he prayed to God to do something about it, and God told him that he was already working on the problem. He was raising up the Chaldeans who would come and punish the people of Judah. And that just added to the prophet's misery, because now he had expected invasion and he thought the Chaldeans were even worse than we are. But here's kind of his wrap-up to that. Back to chapter 3 and verse 16. I heard, and my inward parts trembled. Sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble. Because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. That's affliction. And then the prophet said, though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength, and He has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. And I think of the Apostle Paul writing to the Philippians, in Philippians chapter 4. Broke, beat up, in prison. Most of his friends have abandoned him. He's awaiting trial before Caesar. And he writes to them in Philippians chapter 4, beginning in verse 10. And he says, not now I've rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well to share with me in my affliction. Notice Paul describes himself as being in affliction. Those days were bad. In a lot of ways. But the apostle had a merry heart, a cheerful heart, because he chose to. And so much of our outlook is our own choice. And the key in both of these passages, I hope you noticed that we read, was both of these men could focus on their relationship with the Lord. And that made everything else just fall into place. Good advice from the wise man. Let's pray again. Kind and loving Father of Heaven, we thank You so much for this wisdom that You have preserved for us in this ancient collection of Proverbs. Help us to learn the lessons that are taught from the experience of others and not have to learn everything the hard way. Help us, our Father, to be aware of the challenges before us. Help us to think carefully about them and pray about them, but help us also to be workers and doers and not just those who talk. Help us to be aware of the responses that we make to others and let them be wise and let them be considered and measured that they might have the greatest benefit. And help us, our Father, to have a spirit of cheer based on all that You are and all that You do for us and the richness of the blessings You provide. Help us to keep our focus on that and thereby to keep everything else in perspective. We pray in Jesus' name.